In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We listen to interviews on the subject of what the evidence has shown about the destruction of the World Trade Center towers on September 11, 2001, and subsequent free energy suppression. We'll hear from Dr. Judy Wood, Andrew Johnson, Professor Eric Larson, Attorney Jerry Lephart, Russ Gerst, and Patrick Kelly. For nearly two decades, it's been clear that a well-organized and funded operation has tried to lead people away from the facts and evidence of how the World Trade Center towers disintegrated. It's also clear that the second net alternative media will not tell the truth about Dr. Judy Wood's research, using facts and evidence pointing to the destructive mechanism that caused the towers to come apart. To determine what happened to the towers on September 11th, all available evidence must be considered. On the cover of Dr. Judy Wood's book titled Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11 is a high-resolution photograph capturing one of the towers imploding into a fountain of dust. From the photographer's angle, the tower was about 5 seconds into its destruction, and the top half of the building had vanished, opening a clear view to the Hudson River. Her 500-page book compiles irrefutable scientific evidence of how a destructive mechanism was used to make matter come apart on that day. The book has steered many readers away from the conditioning and disinformation deployed to mislead and distract from the real research since the events on September 11, 2001. Dr. Judy Wood is a former professor of mechanical engineering. Her interests are in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, and the materials characterization of biomaterials and composite materials. She has degrees in civil engineering, structural engineering, engineering mechanics, and got her PhD in materials engineering science from the Department of Engineering Science and Mechanics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and the State University in Blacksburg, Virginia. In 2005, several reports mandated by Congress were issued by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to determine why and how the World Trade Center 1 and 2 collapsed. The word collapse, used to describe the tower's destruction, is inaccurate, by the way. In April 2007, Dr. Judy Wood and Connecticut attorney Jerry Lephart filed a QTEM complaint against contractors such as Applied Research Associates, also known as ARA, who were among the groups tasked to produce the reports. Parts of Dr. Judy Wood's book, titled Where Did the Towers Go?, were submitted as evidence in this case. The evidence shows that both towers turned to dust before a gravity-driven collapse was possible. It's critical to understand that this evidence can't be explained by thermal or kinetic destructive mechanisms. Let's hear from attorney Jerry Lephart.
It is a very difficult bit of reality to address. You almost want to believe in the official governmental nonsensical conspiracy. You know, we're all pretty much programmed to go along and get along. That is the human condition.
But you have to read the book in order to really get a good sense of the irrefutable scientific evidence part. When you just talk about it, it seems incredibly improbable and exotic.
Well, the experience I had, the first bits of information that I saw that had been prepared by Judy Wood, it was a jaw-dropping experience for me. I was trained, my whole adult life as a lawyer to look at evidence and to distinguish what is evidence, what's admissible evidence, and what isn't. And I saw in the material that Dr. Wood was putting together a path through to being able to use admissible evidence. You know, some of this evidence, quite a bit of it, was going to be admissible. So that's what got me onto that path. And then, once again, we were accusing SAIC and ARA of knowing that directed energy weaponry destroyed the World Trade Center. That's what our claim was.
I didn't know that. I thought it was they had defrauded by misrepresenting what had happened in the NIST report.
Well, that's another way of saying it.
Dr. Wood's legal complaint highlights that defendants, such as ARA, are developers and or manufacturers of directed energy weapon systems or components. Therefore, it would be a conflict of interest in producing a truthful report. Dr. Judy Wood's research shows that directed free energy technology exists. As reported on the show nearly a decade ago, destructive directed energy technology not only exists, but it's loaded on military aircraft and used to destroy targets on the ground. That information can be quickly found by visiting the Directed Energy Directorate online. We hear now from Dr. Wood in one of the first interviews broadcast on WBAI.
Well, I start out looking at the evidence because, as I say in my book, if you listen to the evidence carefully enough, it will speak to you and tell you exactly what happened. And if you don't know what happened, keep listening to the evidence until you do, because the evidence always speaks the truth. The key is not to allow yourself to be distracted away from seeing what the evidence is telling you. In other words, don't start with a conclusion, then work backwards, cherry-picking data that would support your conclusion. Also, don't force yourself to taking a multiple-choice test about only the answers you know about. Because if you only know about a slingshot, you know, a bow and arrow, and a pea shooter, you're not going to come up with the right answer. So if you look at the evidence, it will tell you. So I began looking at all the different pieces of evidence, and to keep from biasing my observations, when I classify a particular phenomena, if I don't know exactly what it is, I give it a name, like fuzzballs, fuzzy blobs, fumes. If you call it smoke, and you're assuming fire is the source or is the cause, if you say fumes, something generic, you're not forced into assuming the cause. It's a way of blinding yourself, kind of like a double-blind study, but it's a way of keeping from biasing your observations.
Let's start with fuzzballs. I saw that image in your book, and as it's a photo of people, I think some policemen and some bystanders walking, and there's a cloud of dust around their feet. Tell me why that's significant.
When the building starts to come apart, you see, I call them wheat checks, the outer prefab units of three columns wide by three stories tall, these steel structures that the building was made out of. You see them flying through the air, trailing dust that's just coming out heavily. It looks almost like jet propulsion. And that isn't a dirty windowsill. And then you notice the intersection this is falling towards. Afterwards, the intersection doesn't have anything in it but paper and dust. And there's some outer aluminum cladding. And then pretty soon, that picture that you noticed, it's looking west, about one block north of the North Tower, or where the North Tower had been 5 minutes earlier, or 10 minutes earlier. And the sky is clear, so you know the dust has settled out. And then pretty soon you notice around people's feet these fuzz balls, that's what I call them, this haze that is around their feet. And you say, okay, they kicked up fine dust. But wait a minute, that fine of dust could not have fallen out of the air that quickly. There's a clear, clear air in the where you're looking in that picture. And then pretty soon you notice it coming up all by itself without even needing to be kicked up. What that shows is that coarse dust landed, fell out of the air, and then became fine dust and rose up because it continued breaking down. So So you have the steel that's flying through the air, dust that lands because the steel has now come apart into dust, and then that dust breaks down finer and finer until it rises up into the air and people breathe it. It's on the order of like 1/100th of a red blood cell, about the size of DNA.
The reference there as well, we often talk about geoengineering and the fine particular matter that is being sprayed out of some of these planes up to 10 microns thick. When you breathe, it embeds into the lung lining and into the bloodstream. That's also very important with family members and workers who have been sick and have died.
Right. The dust from the towers, you know, the steel and building material and so forth that broke apart into coarse dust, landed, and then continued breaking down to finer and finer dust, so it rose up like this haze.
What do you say to people who tell you that that dust is just dust from concrete dust and the metal was obviously piled up and everyone saw the metal piled up. It didn't turn to dust. They hauled that stuff away. We don't think you're correct on this.
Well, the dust particles are less than a tenth of a micron in size. That's very fine particles. And it's extraordinarily fine particles. You don't find that in regular controlled demolitions or any other kind of dust. Regular controlled demolitions, you look at them, the dust rises no more than about the maximum height of the building that was being destroyed. It doesn't go up and up and then into the stratosphere or whatnot and down the eastern seaboard.
Dr. Wood, who is trained in observations to recognize something she's never seen before, scientifically revealed how two 110-story buildings weighing 500,000 tons each didn't slam to the ground on September 11, 2001. They instead turned to dust in the air. Her research also shows there is no debris pile relative to the collapse of two 110-story towers. The seismic data recorded at that time and date do not correspond with two 500,000-ton buildings hitting the ground. Well, where did the towers go? Most of it dissolved into dust as it fell through the air. Not just any dust, a fine particulate that kept breaking down into smaller pieces beyond 1 micron in size. That's 1/100th of the size of red blood cells, about the size of DNA. Dr. Wood writes this about World Trade Center 2. We are looking at signs of a force that turned the building to dust before it even had a chance to get to the ground. The official explanation, along with all the theories of controlled demolition, thermite, and so on, would have us believe that we are looking at a gravity-driven collapse. But in fact, what we are seeing is a building being disintegrated into parts so small that it will, in practical terms, disappear. This important observation about the dust continuing to break down into smaller particulates implied that the remaining debris and intact structures within and near Ground Zero were also continually breaking down at the molecular level. This information gives more insight into the possibility of why the 41-story Deutsche Bank building opposite the World Trade Center site was dismantled a decade later. Strangely, in August of 2007, after delivering a radio show to WBAI at the Wall Street location, I saw the Deutsche Bank building smoldering. The air was dry. There was a prominent halo around the sun, likely from the planes actively spraying particulates into the atmosphere. At the scene, construction workers and police pushed people back from the building. Loud cracking against metal and hissing sounded off in the air. In the photographic and video evidence I collected, there was what appeared to be glowing fires, segregated to single floors, similar to the World Trade Center 6. Was the same destructive mechanism used to partially destroy the Deutsche Bank building because it was irreversibly breaking down on the molecular level from the directed energy weapon used on September 11, 2001? Dr. Wood enumerated specific anomalous events that reveal a potential signature of directed energy weapon use and fallout such as glowing areas that appear to be fires with unburnt paper near them, or what appears to be molten metal in the street.
There's some orange stuff and some yellow, bright yellow-white stuff. And you notice it's sitting on paper, what appears to be paper. You also notice pieces of aluminum cladding that came from the building, one which appears to be glowing on the end. Well, if it's glowing because it's hot, aluminum is a puddle. You know, aluminum glows if it's hot enough to glow, but it's a puddle. It's not a rigid body. When it, you know, at the temperature at which it begins to melt, it's this real, real dark red. So the fact that it's glowing means it's glowing for a reason other than because it's hot. Because if it was glowing because it was hot, it would, you know, wouldn't not be holding its shape. And then you see the paper that's scattered around with these orange things on them. I call them Cheetos because you're not going to mistake those for food. You know, the snack food. It's just this orange-shaped thing.
I'm looking at that right now.
And, you know, some of them are sitting on paper. Also, the bright yellow-white coloration is not horizontal. It's not a puddle. So whatever it is, isn't a liquid.
And then you have the material pouring out of the window.
Right.
From the 80th floor.
Glad you called that. Just some material. We don't know what it is, but it stays glowing all the way down. You think of a sparkler. It shoots out sparks, you know, 4th of July sparkler.
Mm-hmm.
But those sparks cool before they hit the ground. They change temperature as they're falling because they're small and they have a lot of surface area. So you get cooled with the wind, with the air. So if something continued to glow all the way down, you know, a quarter mile drop or nearly a quarter mile from, you know, down the tower, you know, why would it still be colored orange? And it doesn't seem likely that it's glowing because it's hot.
These pieces of information become critical evidence in the concept here that you've put together. And the title, the subtitle is Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. Let's talk about Chapter 3 for a minute, the jumpers. And it's a very sensitive topic here, and it's very important information here that you've discovered, again, with very, very keen observational skill here. Why is it important here that we look at the jumpers?
You know, I'm looking at all the evidence, but you remember seeing the pictures of the people hanging out of the windows. And so I was looking at these and then putting myself in their position. If I were in their position and knew, you know, I was about to die or whatnot, you'd have things you'd want to tell people. There's that feeling. And, you know, first you want to look away from this, you know, this idea, but then I felt compelled to fulfill their need and wanted to listen to what they were saying. And putting myself in their position, you know, I feel like I then made them a promise to tell their story. And looking at what they were going through, and you start thinking about it. And pretty soon I noticed this one fellow hanging from the 105th floor by one hand and one foot, taking his pants off. And you look, and other people have their shirts off or their pants off already. And like, wait a minute, if there's fire in there, you want clothing on to protect yourself from the fire. And if I were there and there was a fire, I'd run to the bathroom before we lost water pressure, get my clothing wet, get extra clothing, get it wet, wrapped around my head, and then bolt for the staircase. And I'd be wet. If the sprinklers came on, I'd be wet. If the sprinklers didn't come on, it was hot there, you'd be wet from sweating.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a good chance that they're wet. So why is it so important for them to take their pants off outside? This guy already has taken his shirt off. You know, let's say he has some peculiar reason you don't want to even think about it. Why he needs to take his pants off? Well, why not step inside, take the pants off, and step back out? There's no smoke pouring out of that window. And if there's smoke inside, well, you can hold your breath long enough to take the pants off. It's surely a lot safer than hanging from the 105th floor. And then you pretty soon you realize it's vital that he not be in there with his clothing on. So what situation would cause that? And it leads to thinking about the active denial system for crowd control, which is microwave technology. It makes people feel like their skin is burning.
Right. If their clothing is wet, then it says it's enhanced.
Much more enhanced. And think of a wet paper towel in your microwave oven versus a dry paper towel. You know, one cooks it and one doesn't.
That's a great example.
Some, you know, type of energy field, it seems likely, was in the building that was affecting their clothing. Now, firefighters don't fight fires in the nude. The clothing is protective layer. Just like when you're flipping burgers on the grill, you have a mitt on to, you know, because you're holding your hand over the grill if you don't have long-handled tools.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it seems like. There's something going on there like that. And the number of, quote, jumpers, the number of people who went out of the building and went down, who lost their life that way, is an incredible number.
Yes, you have transcripts of the firemen speaking about this.
Right. Then, you know, typical number is 3 or 4 a minute out of each face. Well, let's say 3 a minute out of each face of the North Tower. So that's, you know, 3 times 4 is 12. So that means 12 a minute out of all 4 faces.
Can you say that again? There was another beep when you said 12.
Okay. So let's pick the lower number, 3. And they have 4 faces, so that's 12 people per minute. And times 100 minutes, that's 1,200 people. And then we know the 343 firefighters who lost their life. That brings us up to 1,543 different bodies that we have DNA for. And that was just about the same number of DNA samples, unique DNA samples. As I did when I went through all of the evidence, is just noting these strange things, these anomalies. Someone who could jump with the gusto of world record standing broad jump from the top of the building, and there's no horizontal air resistance, you know, would just drift away from the building as they went down. That was about where this person was in one of the images. And it becomes hard to understand how they could be that far from the building on the way down. There's some other strange anomalies that come up as well, like someone that turned into a cloud of red, who was reported to turn into a cloud of red. There wasn't a person anymore. It was just a cloud of red. Then there's also the issue of, you know, how much people were broken up. It really strikes you that something else was going on here. And, you know, I set that aside. After I tabulated all the different phenomena that I had observed, not knowing what it meant, one day I happened upon this blog where I saw all the same phenomena exhibited. And that was just, it blew me away. That was the blog of John Hutchison.
Other anomalies include the dust not being smoke, because the smoke would be present at higher temperatures. Welding hoses were laying over debris reported to be at temperatures that would melt it. A metal grappler had picked up what appeared to be glowing metal, but if that metal was glowing hot, the hydraulics wouldn't function normally. There were fumes instead of smoke, fumes instead of steam explosions. It's important also to understand that directed energy weapons are known to be covertly used in conventional warfare and during so-called natural disasters. However, as we've now heard in detail, this weapon leaves a mark, a distinctive fingerprint that can be discerned if you know what you're looking for. We hear again from attorney Jerry Lephart.
We sued contractors who had been retained by NIST to basically carry out the investigation of what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center. And as Judy remarked, NIST admitted to us that, well, they didn't do that. It was science fraud in the classical sense, that you phrase the question so that you do not have to answer that which you are charged with answering. That's why we termed it as fraud. Another phrase that found support in the law that we relied on was willful blindness. You know, you can't pretend that you are addressing the issue and the question that you're being paid for on the one hand and then turn away on the other as if you did not see it. We've used the term contractors. Well, who are we talking about? Well, basically, we're talking about the cream of the crop of the military-industrial complex. These are the companies that actually make the weapons and demonstrate the kind of technology that was shown to have been involved on 9/11.
Dr. Judy Wood.
By Dr. Judy Wood, correct. So that to us was just the straw that broke the camel's back. You have NIST pretending that they don't know what happened and are not therefore investigating it. The companies that included Science Applications International Corp., SAIC, and
ARA,
Applied Research Associates, headquartered in Albuquerque, New Mexico, right next to the military-industrial complex
sites. White Sands,
the missile testing. This is what they do. They make these weapons. And equally important, they also test the lethality effects. So that if they, these are the companies that when they see an explosion, that for them is their work. They have to assess and know how to assess the effects of something that has been destroyed by an application of energy of one sort or another. That is what they do. For us, it added insult to injury to have this 10,000-page report that explained everything except what happened, and then to have a footnote in the report that literally said, well, we didn't investigate that. The investigation stops at the point that the destruction is beginning to take place.
That's what's said in a letter from, the name is Catherine Fletcher. The name is Catherine Fletcher. She wrote this letter to Dr. Judy Wood when you were pressing them on this issue, weren't you? And she actually said that we only investigated the events up to the point of collapse, quote unquote.
Right. And because that letter was addressed to Judy, that, in our view, made her the original source of the information that that is what happened. And we knew who did it because we knew that SAIC and ARA, among other companies, were in actually doing the investigation, and they actually led it, as in the nature of what is termed public-private partnerships, where a governmental entity that actually has the responsibility to do a task basically turns it over to private contractors, and they run it. And SAIC literally ran this investigation and indicated what would be done, what would not be done, what would be looked at, and what would not be looked at. That, to us, was fraud. Virtually all of the documents that were filed in the case, including the request for correction at NIST itself, those are matters of public record. The request for correction is posted up on the Department of Commerce's website, and I believe it's still... You can still access it. And, of course, the book, Where Did the Towers Go?, Dr. Wood's book, is the most comprehensive presentation of this matter that is available. However, a good portion of what is in the book, Where Did the Towers Go?, and a significant fraction of the photographic evidence found in that book, is also filed on record at this website of NIST, an official governmental website, and that's where you can find that evidence to this day. Ultimately, in looking back on this, it may even be to, you know, future generations, one or two generations down the road, when the veil will be lifted over this and people will be able to overcome the cognitive dissonance that has so far prevented people from looking at this, seeing these two 110-story buildings disintegrate right before their eyes and go from 110 stories to no stories, and know that, you know, that's not an ordinary collapse. No amount of airplane jet fuel, kerosene, can cause that degree of annihilation. And people know that, I think, inherently and intuitively, but we're just not in a position right now where we can look at that.
Right now, news about approaching hurricanes take top priority in mainstream media reporting. Yet the reporting of Category 3 Hurricane Erin on September 11, 2001, was buried, virtually secret. By September 10, 2001, Hurricane Erin's wind speeds hit 120 miles per hour. Erin traveled past Bermuda, headed directly for New York City. Dr. Judy Wood notes, the data shows the hurricane slowed down as it approached New York City, then remained almost stationary during the morning of 9/11. However, immediately after the World Trade Center attack, Erin began to move away from the city. For the next 24 hours surrounding the events of 9/11, Hurricane Erin maintained the same wind speed, the same pressure, and approximately the same distance from New York City. From its birth on September 1st to a tropical depression on September 17th, Erin was not only the most underreported hurricane, it was the most tracked and studied hurricane to date. Its eye wall was in the shape of a pentagon, and there was what looked like a maze in the interior of the eye. Dr. Wood writes, the use of directed energy technology on the huge scale of its use during 9/11 might very well have had weather-altering effects. In Chapter 18 of Where Did the Towers Go?, Dr. Wood writes, such technology might have been able to draw upon the vast energies and field effects of the enormous Tesla coil known as Hurricane Erin. Thoughts of this kind are justified, even necessitated, by the fact of Erin's having been treated as a carefully kept secret, much like a state secret. Professor Eric Larson, editor and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press, is a novelist and writer. He's the author of A Nation Gone Blind, America in the Age of Simplification and Deceit, and he published five essays on the September 11, 2001 attacks, including Dr. Judy Wood in the Future of the Earth, parts 1 through 5.
Dr. Judy Wood does not have a theory. The Gage Group said, we know all about her theories already. Well, they don't. If they're using that word, they don't know about her. Because what her book amounts to, what it offers, and what it is a proof, not a theory, but it's a proof that the towers were destroyed by some form of directed energy weaponry, free energy weaponry. And because she can't identify the make, model, and serial number and the location of the presumed origin or source of the weapon, those at least like Fetzer say, well, it can't be. That's supposition and that's theory. But on the other hand, it is not. And if somebody is shot with a .30-06 caliber bullet and they're dead, and if the police don't know where the killer is, where the weapon is, or what color stock the weapon had on it, or what make of cartridge the weapon fired, that makes no difference. The person is still dead of a .30-06 gunshot wound. And similarly with the towers. What got them was molecular dissociation brought about by the field effects in directed free energy technology. And the book is a book that proves that. Jerry Mazza has written on liberal and progressive causes for the Intrepid Report for a long, long, long time, even when it was still called Online Journal. But he won't admit it. He won't admit that science is not different from argument or debate. Science, as I say in Part 5, progresses not by argument, but by proof. And those, many who, for whatever their reasons may be, wish to muddle up or obfuscate or suppress or distort Dr. Wood's book and conclusion, are using that as a method, thinking of science as something that is a matter of argument. It's not. It's a matter of proof. Even in the great things that we call still the theory of, you know, the gravitational theory, the theory of evolution, the relativity theory, science uses the word theory in the sense, a very extraordinarily important sense, that literally, philosophically, if you will, the theory of relativity hasn't been proven, But, of course, it is proven. That is to say, the example of a light switch. If you come into a dark room, turn on the light, and the lights come on. Turn the switch, and the lights come on. And you leave and turn the light switch off, and the light goes off. And you do this for 100 days in a row. You're going to conclude the light's going to come on when you switch the switch.
By what
but
method?
This is by inductive reasoning. If you say to someone, that's then a theory, that the light's going to come on. Well, indeed, it is a theory, because maybe the light won't come on. But scientifically, it's valid because in lieu of anything else happening, like the circuit wearing out, a wire getting frayed, or the bulb burning out, it will indeed come on. People are taking this up as a means by which to attack large proofs of a scientific nature. And they're still doing it, of course, with Darwin. I mean, they're still trying to. But, you know, how do the creationists attack Darwin? They do it by ignoring the evidence every time, again and again. They'll say, hey, we believe in God, and God must have created, you know, animals and their various forms. Darwin showed that, well, maybe God did create them once. I don't know. But he certainly didn't control every single aspect. Or even if he did, there is evolutionary change in observable form that has been for millennia. So the ignoring of evidence is the key means by which to distort or ignore this proof. But the book is a proof. Free energy exists. This is why, too, I've called these essays Dr. Judy Wood and the Future of the Earth. Our very future, our survival, depends on whether we can harness free energy and thus escape the murder of the Earth that we're so far embarked on at this point.
Professor Eric Larson, editor and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press. Free energy technology has been harnessed, as Dr. Wood presents in her book, but not for good use. Among the major problems for those involved in developing free energy devices are murder, threats of murder, and the lack of funding to develop workable prototypes. Dr. Wood references the science of cold fusion, or more accurately termed transmutation, from the artifact remains in the destruction of the towers, such as bent beams, slow bending of metals, tritium formation, and melting without heat. In an interview with Russ Gerst, CPA and mathematics major, we discuss the cold fusion story and Dr. Eugene Malov's book, Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth in the Cold Fusion Fuhrer. We now hear part of that interview. Russ, let's look at the darker side of what's going on here, because there have been suspicious murders. And we'll start with Dr. Eugene Malov, author of Fire from Ice, a very important book that describes in detail the cold fusion story and the players involved. How was he murdered? What happened there?
Well, he was actually, I believe, at his childhood home. His parents, I believe, had passed away. And he was at his childhood home where they had lived. And he was doing some cleaning up around the property. I don't know if they were getting ready to sell the place or whether he was just maintaining it or just what. But he was shot, I believe, in the back of the head. And it was almost execution style, you know, the type of murder that it was. I believe they did catch some people that they supposedly had murdered him, but again, it was a very shady thing, and the heck of it was in 2004, and this was just before the whole 9/11 truth thing came out, and of course, you know, Dr. Stephen Jones's coming out party, and you know, over the 13 or 14 years since Fire from Ice had been created, Dr. Malov was able to learn a lot more about the behavior of Stephen Jones and how he had basically trashed what Pons and Fleischman had done. So, you know, had he come out as the face of 9/11 truth and then started doing the same things that he did back in 1989, Malov would have been the first one to raise his hand and say, something doesn't smell right here.
And he would have been credible.
Oh, he'd have been very credible. I mean, he would have recognized exactly what was going on. So, yeah, his murder is very suspicious from that very perspective.
Russ, you formulated a very interesting timeline that revealed that wasn't the only murder involved here with people, brilliant minds researching this area of free energy. Can you describe a little bit about how you formulated that timeline and then that other murder?
Well, another murder of an individual was to a Michael Zeber, and his name is spelled, I think it's Z-E-B-U-H-R. What's interesting about that is, one, he was a graduate student of Dr. Judy Wood. She had kind of shown him the research that she had done to this point related to 9/11 and Ground Zero. That was about the time that Jones and actually Dr. Wood were kind of butting heads over being able to share the evidence and share the research. He suddenly was killed. He was on spring break up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. A couple of young African-American gentlemen shot him execution style, just like Eugene Malov. Well, the connection to Eugene Malov gets even better, because Michael Zeber had an uncle, William Zeber, who was actually like the assistant editor or second in command of a magazine called Infinite Energy that Eugene Malov was putting together. And they had been putting it together for many years after the whole cold fusion thing, and it actually tracked that research by those people who were still doing it. So that now all of a sudden you have the connection of Michael Zeber with Eugene Malov right there.
To some people, this is seen to send a message. To those interested in researching this area of free energy, or even the title of the magazine, Infinite Energy, it may have worked. But you put that together, that timeline. Can you describe that timeline a little bit? You don't have to go into too much depth, but I think it's interesting for listeners to get a understanding of the series of events.
Well, basically the timeline gets back into who the players were back in 1989, the relation between Steve Coonan and Caltech, Crockett Grabe and Caltech, related to the cold fusion fiasco, and then comes forward and says, okay, here's all the different things that transpired with the 9/11 cover-up and who the players were and, you know, what happened to them over the course of time. Now, one of the other events that actually occurred, when Dr. Wood was putting together, first she put together a request for correction with NIST so that she could be on record as having actually pointed out the problems with their reporting and the frauds that existed with what was reported upon. After she did the request for correction and it was denied, she then filed a federal QI-TAM whistleblower case in which she basically said that the folks that were the subcontractors for NIST, who were engineering firms, you know, the ARAs, the SAICs, Scientific Applications International Corp., these people should have known what they were seeing when they saw it. And obviously they didn't do the things that they were commissioned to do, because they never did prove how the buildings came apart. They just quit when they said collapse was initiated and it was inevitable that the buildings would come apart, and they quit. So they didn't really de-engineer anything related to that. Well, when Dr. Wood actually was in the process of filing the QI-TAM case, all of a sudden we had this major shooting at Virginia Tech. Now, for those people that don't know, Dr. Wood did all of her undergrad and postgraduate work at Virginia Tech. What's interesting is that where these events occurred were precisely in the dorm as well as the actual building that she attended and actually lived in. Now, there were actual professors and students in the mechanical engineering department where she actually did all of her studies that were killed in all of this. And there were also people killed in the dorm where she stayed, on the exact same floor that she actually lived on. So in retrospect, you say, well, it's coincidental, but it's like, how coincidental can it be? As I was following all of these different things that are on this timeline, I got to thinking about Crockett Grabe, because he had come out as a supporter of Dr. Jones and had written numerous articles for him, and actually had written one against Dr. Wood. What he basically had been involved with back at the University of Iowa, I got to thinking about. There was a similar situation that occurred at the University of Iowa in the fall of 1991. And this was exactly 3 months to the day after his book had come out on space weapons. There was a supposed doctoral student in the physics department, which is the specific department that he was in, that went in and started shooting on a shooting rampage just exactly like Virginia Tech. And, you know, at the time that Virginia Tech occurred, it got me to thinking about what had happened at the University of Iowa, because it was exact modus operandi. You had the same, it was an Oriental, I think he was Chinese, they were both Chinese graduate students who went on a shooting rampage and supposedly killed a bunch of people. When I went back at the University of Iowa, and I thought, well, does Dr. Graby have any connection to it? Was he a witness to it? Has he ever written on it? And as it turns out, he wrote an article 7 years after the fact for the Des Moines Register, talking specifically about being right there.
That was Russ Gerst, a mathematics major and CPA, who helped Dr. Wood publish Where Did the Towers Go? Retired civil engineer Patrick Kelly compiled a list of free energy devices into a 1-million-word ebook, which has been part of the In Other News Archives premium for several years. His work and research has also been plagued by severe interference. He's had 6 different websites destroyed and further access denied so that he couldn't fix the sites. His main email account was hacked, all messages intercepted with spurious, damaging emails sent back in his name. We hear from Patrick describing some of the inventors, the interference, and their work.
Let's start with people that I know personally. There's a mechanical engineer with his own workshop and business in India called Ravi Raju. And he produced a replication of Dave Lawton's hydrogen fuel cell, what Stan Mayer called a water fuel cell. And he was doing experiments on this, and he was publishing on YouTube videos of where he got to and what his measurements were and so on. And he was raided one day by 5 carloads of thugs who took his papers, took his materials, took some tools, took his cell, and told him to stop talking about these things. It was actually quite funny, as it happened, because he had just decided that he'd done as much as he wanted to do with the hydrogen cell, and he was going to move on to deal with magnetic devices. But this is an instance whereby inventors or developers or experimenters are harassed to a very considerable degree. They claimed that they were from the VAT office. He talked to the VAT office afterwards, and they said that they knew nothing whatsoever about any of these people, that they were nothing whatsoever to do with the VAT office, the value-added tax office, the general taxation. So that's one instance of somebody that I know. Another person I've met is Bob Boyce in America. Bob is expert in doing hydrogen devices and electrolysis of water and other things. In fact, one of the driving mechanisms that Bob Boyce produced has been used by a guy in South Africa to self-charge a battery. The battery powers Bob's circuit, and the circuit actually charges the battery that's driving it. And this guy has got a little daughter, and his little daughter has a car driven on a car battery. And during the day, she'd drive around in this thing and have fun. And at night time, her father would attach this charger to the battery itself, and it would recharge the battery overnight, ready for the next day, which is pretty interesting because in theory that's impossible. But in practice, he's done it more than 30 times. But Bob had a design which was very popular with 100 flat plates creating a very large amount of HHO gas, typically 100 litres per minute maximum, 50 litres per minute being a constant. The difference being that it's difficult with 100 litres a second to actually stop the splashing caused by the bubbles coming out of the liquid. It's quite difficult to stop that getting out into the gas output because the gas flow is quite high. So it's quite difficult to actually get a baffling system which will stop the droplets but let the gas go through at high speed. But Bob was in developing his system in his workshop behind his house, and he was running the engine of a car in his workshop on this HHO gas when he was approached by the cops. Now, the cops said that he was due to have a 3.5 year long jail sentence for running a vehicle on an unapproved fuel, which is, of course, rubbish. But anyway, this was the excuse that they were using. But Bob went to court and managed to beat the charge there in court, which a lot of people wouldn't have done. But it was ridiculous. I mean, he was doing it in his workshop behind his house. He wasn't on a public road, and there's no reason at all why he shouldn't run his vehicle on HHO anyway. But that was one of the steps. Another step then was he was befriended by somebody who I would never have trusted, called Major Todd Hathaway of the U.S. military. And miraculously, Todd seemed to have lots of money, much more than you would expect of a major. And he funded Bob and bought him a car and so on for running tests on. But after a while, Todd brought a message from the U.S. military to Bob Boyce. And the message was that while he was allowed to produce boosters to improve miles per gallon performance on vehicles, he was not allowed to run a car on water alone. Now, that's something very interesting. First of all, it shows that the U.S. military is under the control of the New World Order, and it also shows that suppression of engineering and scientific information is completely rife in the United States. But what happened then was they then tried to discredit Bob. First of all, they got somebody to approach him and say, I'd like to manufacture booster cells to your design. Can we get together and make an arrangement?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that Bob went along with that, and he visited this other guy, also called Bob, surprisingly. And when he was there, he was drugged, and two radio frequency ID chips were embedded into his right shoulder when he was asleep. He wasn't aware of it.
Wow, they chipped
They
him.
Eventually went cancerous, and that's how he discovered them. And he had a doctor remove one of them. The doctor then refused point blank to admit that he'd taken it out of Bob's shoulder, but then discovered that there was a second one there. So he had that taken out, and he posted pictures of that online as what had been in his shoulder. These are devices that can be activated and respond back when they run into a radio frequency signal.
It's been argued that the same forces that wield directed energy weaponry in destroying the World Trade Center towers are the same forces suppressing free energy development, are the same forces spraying the atmosphere with soft metal powder while laying the blame of climate change at your doorstep, are the same forces that want to stack and pack humans into urban centers, are the same forces that saturate human environments with microwave radiation, and have entrained generations to stare at microwave devices, and so on. It's been said that the solution is in the environment. It might be as easy as living simply. Patrick Kelly says nearly all free energy devices operate in an open system. Closed systems exclude cosmic particles, temperature, gravity, sunlight, tidal and electromagnetics. In Chapter 22, Conclusions and Summary of Dr. Wood's book, she writes in Final Thoughts, "We stand at the dawn of an entirely new age, By all the evidence, man has in his hands a method of disrupting the molecular basis for matter and the ability, very possibly, to split the Earth in half on a moment's notice. The technology demonstrated on September 11, 2001 can indeed split the Earth in half, or it can be used to allow all people to live fruitful, constructive, and non-polluting lives through the use of free energy. He who controls the energy controls the people. Control of energy, depending on what the energy is, can either destroy or sustain the planet. We have a choice. We can live happily and fruitfully and productively, or we can destroy the planet and die. Every last one of us, along with every living being on this planet. These are the reasons I've spent so much time studying the evidence of what happened on 9/11. 9/11 was a demonstration to the world of a new technology known as free energy. This is a force that can be used for demonic, ruinous, earth-destructive purposes, or it can be used for the good of us, of the earth, and of our civilizations. We have a choice, and that choice is ours. But in order to exercise that choice, in order to be equipped to exercise it, we must keep our eyes open wide and our minds, both our scientific and our social humanist minds, unvaryingly on high alert. After all, two of the very tallest buildings in the world went missing on that awful, grievous day in September, and yet no one continued to ask, where did the towers go? Now we know the answer to that extraordinary question, the question that should have been asked by every one of us long before now. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archived shows and more information about the guests.